Alternative Rock at WVRU, 1988 to 1996. The toil of waking up at the break of dawn usually guarantees morning drive DJs that they'll conduct their show in complete solitude. But on this chilly morning in 1988, WVRU staff members packed the small on-air studio in the second floor of the station's headquarters at 88 Benevolent Street. Silence permeated the room as the DJ's finger rested easily on the red play button, which, once pressed, would be the payoff of many months of hard work.
At exactly 6 in the morning, WBRU injected the airwaves with a new sound that marked the end of WBRU's time as New England's finest rock and the beginning of the cutting edge. Here's Neil Bernstein, class of 88.
We put together a catalog, and we changed the slogan, and we changed all the production, and we did all this stuff to sort of prepare for it. And we didn't talk about it at all on the air, except for the last weekend. We kind of hinted at it coming. And Monday morning, 6 a.m., the whole staff was there to kind of see it come in. And the first song we played was Waterfront by Simple Minds. It starts with a very distinctive bass line.
With the introduction of the cutting edge of rock in 1988, students at WBRU played music that both matched their taste as well as that of a young generation of listeners.
You know, the music sounded great. Everybody who was playing the music kind of breathed a big sigh of relief because it was like, well, this is the music we love anyway, so why shouldn't we be playing this? And it was so much fun.
Hi, BRU.
How you doing?
Great.
Good, I'm listening to your program. I think you got a great idea with doing the cutting edge thing.
Oh, you better believe it.
Go. At least it's not the same old boring stuff that I hear on that other radio station.
All right, thanks for the call.
All right, bye-bye.
I don't know, and just this morning I heard something on the radio, I think it was Friday night, about listening to BRU Monday morning. So I get into work and the station was on HJY. I was like, nah, we're going to switch over to BRU today. And I went over to BRU and I swear to God, everything you've been playing, I've been just jumping in the aisles, you know, it's making me work so much better.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Hi, WBRU.
This is the reason I listened to BRU in the first place. Quite a few years ago, it was like this. You know, the real edge.
I know what you mean.
That's when I got hooked on it, and I kept listening to it ever since, and this is just the way I'd like to see it go.
Hey, I'm glad to hear it.
I like it. I like it a lot.
All right, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Hi, BRU. What do you think of the new sound?
I don't know what you mean by the new sound.
The cutting edge of rock.
Yes, definitely. Well, it's always been.
Thanks. Thanks. I like to hear it.
And then we got a bunch of other calls. People who've been listening to BRU since the 60s. You know, listening to the Stones and the Beatles and the Who. And they were so angry at us. It was like we killed off a friend of theirs. You know? Because all of a sudden, this music that they just loved, that they'd probably grown up with, it was just gone, at least from us. And now they're thinking, oh my God, I'm not going to get to hear the Beatles anymore unless I also take it with a dose of Metallica.
The hype around the station's programming facelift was soon overshadowed by larger financial troubles. Starting in 1989, WBRU began to lose money. Over the next 3 years, WBRU lost over $500,000. Spending could not be cut fast enough, and revenues continued to decline. This forced student managers and the board of directors to re-examine WBRU's financial model. David Malm was president of the board for many years.
At that time, the station had sort of gone into a cyclical downturn, and it was actually sloppy less on the programming side because the ratings that had held up, sales department effectiveness had really tanked.
The board of directors at the time stated a few main reasons for WBRU's financial decline. More competition targeting the youth demographic, greater consolidation in the radio industry, a sagging local economy, and a student body that paid more attention to their classes and therefore had less time for WBRU. Jacob Levy was in the class of 1993.
There had been a wave of significant radio station ownership consolidation over the previous several years, and BRU was left as the last major commercial FM station in Providence that didn't have a pretty big corporate parent. Additionally, as always, BRU was struggling to maintain an air sound that was quite as good or quite as professional as everyone else. And musically, this was the time just before Nirvana and grunge reinvigorated listener interest in alternative as a format. We had come off the late 80s boom time with fairly significant cash reserves, but the bust that hit New England starting in 1990 or so was just devastating for radio advertising revenues. And we were burning through those cash reserves very quickly. We had been losing money through overspending for a while, even during the boom times.
Eric Schultz.
We decided that, and this is the board now, decided that it would be a good idea to look at becoming the first NPR, National Public Radio station in Providence, in Rhode Island, in fact.
The board of directors set out to investigate the possibility of turning BRU into a national public radio station.
In the fall of 91, the board of directors and the managers brought the students in for really intensive discussions to say, look, it's genuinely not sustainable. We're 12 months from being just out of money, and we need to do something very different very quickly. And what they proposed and what, for a time, we, meaning the students and the board jointly, agreed on was to try to retool as an NPR station.
We had a massive station board meeting one night, one afternoon, and presented it and said, this is the way the board would like to go. And the students ended up rejecting the idea.
NPR seemed to the students at the time like something that we could do with relatively few changes to the station. Over the course of the next 6 months, which corresponded with the beginning of my time as general manager, as we dug further in and worked on trying to make that transition as soon as possible, we realized how dramatic the changes would be, that the music format would be not just amended, but pretty thoroughly gone, and that the student direction of the station would be pretty thoroughly gone, that NPR as an organization wasn't going to put up with real student management, that it was going to want professionals in the top levels of the station, and that the business of professional fundraising was going to be just as thoroughly professionalized as the business of commercial sales, if not more. But it became clear that despite that level of work, there wasn't going to be a level of enthusiasm for staffing it, that too many students were too attached to the station as it was and were too interested in being heavily involved at a greater than internship level, and that there were going to be just mass departures from everyone who knew what to do with the station the best, which meant the transition wouldn't work.
A group of alumni heard about the NPR idea. The alumni, among which was David Malm, offered to help make a plan to maintain WBRU's rock format by restructuring the sales force and hiring a new general sales manager.
The level of student energy and enthusiasm that was now built up to try to save the station meant that, at least now for the first time in 4 or 5 years, students were wholly focused on fixing things. And by 93 or so, it was clear that the general radio market was recovering, that BRU's share of the radio market was recovering, and that while we had needed fairly significant changes in the way the station ran, it could still be a student-managed, student-operated station, it could still be a primarily rock format station, and it could still be a commercial station rather than a donation-supported station.
Randy Hershoff came in and turned everything around. As general sales manager, he worked hard to put together a strong sales force that would professionally represent the station in the marketplace. The new plan also instituted greater financial controls. Mary Dalton, the station's first controller, was hired.
It was a horror story. We had to set up a set of books. There was no sets of books. Things that were done, if you were a freshman in high school doing bookkeeping, you never would have done them that way.
Randy Hershoff, we'll go down, I am confident, in history of BRU as far and away the single most valuable professional employee the station has ever had.
After a steep decline, WBRU shot up higher than ever. In 1993 and 1994, the station took first place in the Rolling Stone Readers' Poll under the category of Best Media Market Radio Station.
Oh, God, yeah, they were thrilled. They were thrilled. We had thousands and thousands of copies sent to the station, and they passed them out everywhere.
Yeah, everyone was really excited. You know, they came, and we all sat out in front of the building, and they took our picture, and we had those little framed Rolling Stone covers hanging in the building, and so it was sort of a mark of, you know, success.
In the early 90s, WBRU worked hard to solidify its role as the main outlet for alternative rock in southern New England.
Half the leadership team was students and half were professionals, and obviously the students are sort of mixing this with classes, and there's a new one every year. So when you have any group, any subset of the leadership team that stays there for a while, and then some other subset that changes every year, the people that have been there for a while kind of end up de facto, you know, making more decisions, kind of having more control over things.
By 1994, WBRU employed a fully professional sales staff, controller, traffic manager, program director, and chief engineer. The number of professional employees on staff caused reduced student participation in the business side of the station and little or no involvement at all in the sales department and tech department. Here's Jacob Levy.
The central theme of BRU since, you know, 1981 has been a constant tension as to how you define the educational workshop. And I think it ebbs and flows, and you have extremes. You have, you know, on one extreme, you have, you know, general managers who come in who are like David Malm and view the educational workshop as, gee, this is great. I'm a student. I get to either, you know, be general manager or a disc jockey or, you know, whatnot, have you, at the station, and actually really go out and compete in the marketplace. You know, what could be more educational than that? And then on the other hand, you have a view which is equally valid. This is a workshop. We should try to facilitate as many different experiences as we can at WBRU and make just enough money so that we can do that.
As the board and student management attempted to provide the best learning conditions at WBRU, the radio industry itself was becoming increasingly consolidated, and there were already signs that the strength of WBRU-FM would once again be tested, both from without and within. And in the meanwhile, WBRU-AM barely existed at all.
And that sort of was sad, right? I mean, it was there, the opportunity was there, but there was no proper way for people to listen to BRU-AM, and people lost interest and sort of sat basically dormant until we showed up.
In 1994, Daniel Oppenheim arrived on campus and made it his mission to bring traditional college radio back to Brown University. At the end of his first semester at Brown, Daniel became general manager of WBRU-AM, and Oliver Hurst Hiller became sports director, a job that had been vacant for years.
And so in November or December of 94, we took over. We were all freshmen. We sort of took over from all seniors. And we began to explore finding, you know, a more robust, more reliable, a real, you know, signal for the station. Whenever we did promotions and whenever we just spread the word just amongst our friends, we got great turnouts. It was such a tremendous interest on campus, and that was one of the most gratifying parts of it, which that we knew that people were interested in participating in what we were doing, and if only we could realize a better way to get the signal out, to get our broadcast out, we would have, you know, an amazing broadcast.
Dan and Oliver spent months exploring the possibility of reviving the carrier current system, but it was technically unfeasible.
WBRU's engineer, Craig Healy, suggested the possibility of looking into the Wheeler School signal, WELH, at 88.1 FM.
I remember walking around the facility for the first time and being and having this like shock that they had this their own FCC license, 150 watts, covered most of Providence, like the top third of Rhode Island, and it was like essentially being programmed by like computer jazz music and like and Rick College on Sunday, and that was like completely, you know, not taken advantage of.
Oppenheim started negotiating a deal to broadcast sports on Wheeler with the help of Hurst Hiller.
We wanted to get on the air, and we had the athletic department sitting there saying, well, we'll subsidize this. With the actual exception of football, because they had somebody covering football somehow, they were essentially saying to us, look, broadcast as much as you can.
With airtime and listeners on the horizon, the sports department blossomed into a 20-person operation.
We had none of us had ever done this before, and we did, to our discredit, we did zero research. So we were wrestling with things like basic tactical things. We just didn't know what we were doing. What if one of us has to go to the bathroom? We didn't know. Like, we're on the air, we're live. You can actually hear us on 88.1 FM. What happened, right? What do we do with 25 minutes of halftime?
Perry back to pass, under pressure, gets the screen pass away to Milan. Milan has some room, gets a nice block, and breaks out. He's got some space, goes 10-5, dives to the end zone. Touchdown, Bears!
Both, I got excited because it seemed like there was potential and interest. And Dan got excited as well because he was sitting there going, you know, perhaps this could be our first step towards getting the station on the air, and it could be, you know, this is our foot getting stuck in the door that we use to then, you know, crack the door open and pull our whole body through and actually have a full-blown radio station with more than just sports content.
The summer of 1995, confident that sports airtime on WELH and the leaky wire on 96.5 would be successful, WBRU AM realized that they needed a new name. They couldn't be WBRU AM because the AM carrier current was gone. They chose Brown Student Radio, BSR, to distinguish themselves from BRU, but they still struggled to find a broadcast outlet.
There were multiple ventures which did not pan out. I mean, Dan spent hours and hours and days and weeks on the leaky wire attempt to broadcast. That did not pan out, right? We both spent a ton of time pursuing our own license, something that, frankly, has enamored every single person who's ever managed BSR.
Not only that, Oliver, we approached Wheeler sophomore year and offered to buy the station from them.
You're right. I forgot we tried to buy the station. Imagine two sophomores who come across as such.
Right.
And we literally walked in after. Yeah, we're wearing like sneakers, jeans, hat backwards. We probably have like food on our shirt from the ratty.
Right.
And we walk in after probably not more than 9 months of broadcasting with them. They're probably trying to decide whether we get a third hour and a fifth hour of a week.
Right.
And I think we tried to buy the station.
No, Oliver, we
had Bud McGorian on board. There was money behind us. We had a trustee from the board on board. We literally walked in and tried to buy the station from them.
And we had serious conversations for months. It didn't die for 4 months, and it really, unfortunately, that they tried to wanted to exchange land.
Oh my God!
Land at the Pembroke Field, which is like 2.5 acres of prime. College Hill real estate for the station, which is at what point Brown turned and said, this is not a productive conversation.
Meanwhile, the WBRU-FM management had its own worries. In 1995, one of Jacobs Media's trademarked Edge stations signed on in Providence at 99.7. The station directly challenged WBRU's identity as the cutting edge of rock, even more so after changing their name to 99.7X, The Cutting Edge, in 1997. Seth Ressler was in the class of 99.
So all of a sudden, this alternative format exploded, and they started doing this very cookie-cutter alternative radio station in a can, just pick it up and drop it all over the country kind of thing. And so one signed on here. And the music industry was predicting that BRU would go under in about 6 months. Because this was professionals. This was, you know, this wasn't a bunch of college kids. This was, you know, real guys coming in and doing researched radio and this, that, the other thing.
Here's Pam Young, class of 98.
There was a lot of panic. I think there was a lot of buzz. Not a whole lot of experience with this sort of competition. And for me personally, it was a time when obviously I felt, you know, I cared deeply about the station. It was my favorite station since I was 13. And I wanted to make sure that it survived in some way. And at the same time, I was also involved in the news department, which was directly under threat from this commercial competition. There was some talk about scaling back on the amount of news that was going to be on the air. And I remember when I first got on, if I remember correctly, I think we had a good 5 minutes per newscast. And I think by my sophomore year, the program director was pushing for cutting that down to half the length. And news was not the only thing that was threatened. I think the major thing that came up during my sophomore year was about 360.
The radio station hired a consultant to basically do research, to do market research. They basically wanted to find out, okay, are we gonna get killed by this new radio station or not? You know, what do you not like about WBRU? You know, the one thing that everybody said, which is kind of a no-brainer, plays rap on Sundays. So the consultant comes up with it. You know, look, you should think about it. All your alternative rock fans are turning off their radio on Sundays, which was true. The one thing that he kind of failed to note is that while all the alternative rock fans were turning off their radios on Sundays, there was a whole bunch of other people that were turning their radios on Sundays. And whereas the alternative rock fans would come in for 15 minutes and go away for 15 minutes and come, you know, throughout the week, the guys who turned their radios on Sunday turned them on and left them on all day Sunday.
In the spring of 1996, station membership met to discuss the possibility of terminating 360. Pam Young was affirmative action officer during the 360 debates.
And so I then became the main liaison between general management and the 360 staff, none of whom were on station membership. The people who were defending it and the people who were suggesting that it should go, none of us were personally involved in 360. A lot of us didn't even know exactly who those people were that were on the air on Sunday.
At the time, too, there was no real hip-hop station in Providence. And, you know, the 360 students go on the air. And by the way, no decision had been made about this or anything. But the 360 students, I think they went on the air and said, well, you know, look, you got to save 360 and this, that, the other things. And all of a sudden, the community's upset.
We did decide to get rid of it. We did decide to get rid of it. I think that was the vote, and I think that was what precipitated the protest outside of BRU.
In May 1996, community leaders and students protested outside the WBRU studios at 88 Benevolent Street. Mary Dalton, the controller at the time, recalls the incident.
Went to lunch, came back, and damn near died. Across the whole front, the street, the whole nine yards, these people were all picketing with NCAA signs. And the TV stations were there and everything. And somebody met me and told me, come quick, get in the station through the back door, and you can't leave. And it was scary. And I'll tell you, that was the most scared I've ever been working in a place.
And I do recall the news actually landing in a little blurb in USA Today about some radio station in Providence, Rhode Island, causing a lot of ruckus in the community.
If you're the president of a university, the last thing you want in the world is a picture of African Americans protesting outside the radio station associated with your university. My understanding is that Vartan Gregorian, who was the president, basically called up and said, I don't care what you're doing. Stop it now. And that was the end of that conversation.
Meanwhile, Oppenheim was dealing with another crisis. Would his efforts with BSR turn into anything?
I was concerned that here I was nearing the end of my time at Brown. It was already, you know, middle of my junior year, and that Oliver and I were going to depart, and that we weren't going to be able, we didn't solidify anything, and that whatever gains we made, yes, we improved the studio, but it was still in BRU, and yes, we had these Brown sports broadcasts, but that only would last as long as we could keep people interested and we could still buy time on Wheeler, you know.
In the fall of 1996, Oppenheim ran for general manager of WBRU-FM. He'd sat on BRU's executive board since becoming BRU-AM's general manager in the fall of 1994.
I think I saw going to BRU and working at BRU, improving BRU as an opportunity to help, you know, as just an opportunity to change radio at Brown and make it more fitting and more inclusive.
Dan's strongest opponent in the very tight race was Pam Young.
In terms of Dan Oppenheim, it was a really tough race. I won by one vote.
And I lost, and I think that I was quite upset at the time, I remember. But I think that as they say, it was for the best because I renewed my energy into BSR and finding a final voice, a permanent home before I left. And that resulted in going back to Wheeler and negotiating with them about buying a block of time and do like a limited broadcast on Wheeler.
In the year leading up to BSR's debut on 88.1 FM, the need for an alternative outlet on campus became increasingly visible. Nick No, 99, served as a catalyst.
In these 2 years or so, all of a sudden, a bunch of folks decided, hey, let's try and push as many buttons as possible. And we pushed them.
In October, No wrote a letter to the editor of the Brown Daily Herald in which he challenged WBRU to a public debate. Young declined the invitation in an editorial several days later.
Yeah, Nick No, I remember him. That was a really interesting interaction. It wasn't what I thought was best for the station, and so I didn't do it.
And, at the end, we thought that BRU's position was kind of indefensible, mainly that, you know, they may be one of the most prominent college radio stations in the country, but, at the end of the day, you know, what is the value of that? And should they be the most prominent college radio station in the country, or should they be really the most innovative? The BRU folks were kind of shocked because, you know, for 20 years, no one had really asked them, you know, hey, what are you doing with this incredible resource in the community and beyond? This was basically, you know, some kind of jobs factory, or this was some kind of, you know, vocational factory.
I mean, I even heard it from my friends who kind of joked about it and, you know, kind of nudged me on the side. It's like, oh, you're just such a sellout. But I don't think that I ever got that sort of confrontation from anybody else aside from Nick No.
Dan Oppenheim.
I don't fault BRU. I think it's a valuable asset. It's a unique asset for Brown to have, for any university to have. At the same time, unfortunately, it came at the expense of Brown having a proper, more traditional college radio station.